Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, January 7th, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxel. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we're talking with Drew Meyer from Adaptec, well, the Snap Server division of Adaptec, about network storage. But in general, we're talking about storage. The entire month of January, we're talking about storage solutions. We'll be talking next week about Seagate, about portable drives. And then we'll be talking about with Plexar about CDs and DVDs. And we're rounding up with Nero software from Nero Corporation. That's the whole month this month on Geek Speak, storage for you. And we're starting off this day with network storage. You're welcome to join the conversation in the second half of the show, 476-2800, or toll free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us. I'll give that information out again when I invite your participation in about 25 minutes. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxel. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, Java programmer, web developer, and student of American literature, and our guest, Drew Meyer. Meyer. Thank you about that. Sorry about that. From Adaptec, an avid lover of open source software and marketing manager for products at Adaptec, specifically Snap Division, Snap Appliance Division. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you.
Good morning.
We're going to start the news segment before we get into this discussion about storage and network storage. We're going to start the news with Miles, sir.
Well, this is a shout-out to all the ham radio operators out there. A new miles per watt world record has been set. A ham radio operator in New London, North Carolina, correctly copied a message a distance of 546.8 miles while only putting out 40.6 millionths of a watt, which works out to be 13,467,980 miles per watt.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And in another related note, mm-hmm. as just going out to the ham radio community, apparently ham radio has served as the main link to the disaster area in Southeast Asia.
Of course. Now, let me ask you, Miles, a while ago, we've talked throughout history on the show about how IP over power could really interfere with ham radio operation.
Over power lines, yeah.
Over power lines, that's right. Especially in the low wattage, not to be confused with
power over Ethernet.
No, right, not power over Ethernet, but Ethernet over power lines.
Right.
And that it's actually being loaded. I mean, it's being used in some areas now. Some cities are launching
pilot programs.
I would assume that this exceptional delivery of, I would assume, audio content via low wattage would probably be disturbed. But would general ham radio usage be disturbed with this? You looked into it for a while.
There is a question about it. It is theoretically possible to avoid the interference, but the question is whether or not you're going to whether power companies in practice will put in necessary filters to stop interference on the frequencies that are used by ham radio operators.
All right. Well, so it's cool. In the story about ham radio, low power ham radio, did it specify what was broadcast? Did he say specific words? Normally, when advances in technology, if you will, of audio, you normally hear about the first words spoken and such. You know, what did was done on the phone for the first time? Either of your call
was it? How now? No, Watson, come here. How now, Brown Cow? I don't know.
Something silly like that that became kind of the moniker.
Yeah. It says correctly copied an 80-meter CW beacon at Wappingers Falls.
So it sounded like this. Swing that. Well, that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
Thank you for the story. Drew, I'm going to go to you, sir.
Well, I don't have a lot of, you know, nothing as fascinating as a distance of 548.6 miles, but this year there have been a couple of news stories that have recently come out in regarding storage, which is really what I'm here to talk about and what I know the best about, so you guys will excuse me for my focus here. But the year of 2005, we expect to be a sort of the knee in the curve is the term in marketing that we use, where the adoption rate of a new technology really kind of kicks in and jumps over the gap and really starts off and becomes more of a standardized used technology. And the particular technology that I'm talking about is called iSCSI. Not to be confused with regular SCSI or small computer systems interface that most computer folks are aware of as an interface between drives and storage systems and drives and ways to transfer data between drives and computers. Not that kind of SCSI. This is iSCSI, which has a lowercase I in front of the capital SCI, and that stands for Internet SCSI or SCSI over IP. So you're taking the data and transferring it over the Internet.
Well, so is it more like the file system rather than a hard drive format? Or
it's a little bit different from a file system. It's the block-level protocol. It's what's the disk is addressing. The disk is thinking in its own native language, in other words, but it's able to transfer that over long distances using Ethernet rather than just the distances measured in meters that you used to use with SCSI. So ultimately, the point I'm trying to make here is that this year we expect 2005 to be the high adoption curve rate for iSCSI, this new technology. And as I talk more in the show, I think I'll keep coming back to this. But keep an eye out, keep an ear out for that term. You guys will start hearing it more and more.
What will it enable? What does it help?
Good question. It enables iSCSI means that you have can now use the Ethernet infrastructure in your home or business or in the world essentially to transfer storage related data. Now, there's some subtleties here, and so most people may not care, or that doesn't sound like a big deal out of the gate, but it really matters because now I can have my storage located, for example, in San Jose. I can have my application server located in Phoenix, and as far as the application server is concerned, that storage is locally connected and it's across the room, when in reality it's across the country.
Wow.
So there's a huge cost benefit for small businesses who are looking to transfer data over long distances.
Or large businesses.
Of course, large businesses don't want new costs.
You could see a situation with enough bandwidth that a company wouldn't actually have their data local at all. It would all be redundantly stored somewhere safe and cool, and they're accessing it normally.
That's possible, and that's an extreme example. I mean, I'm using that to illustrate a point.
How is that kind of technology better than, for example, mounting an NTFS remotely? NFS, sorry.
Should we dig into that kind of detail here?
Before
we go into that, we kind of need to draw a parallel, make a point here about file systems versus really block-level hard drive storage. Yeah. And what you just spoke of, NFS is a file system used for Unix systems, and NTFS is the file system used for Windows, or SIFS as it's commonly called, or SMB. Those are all really meaning the same thing. The file system that Windows uses to address files on the computer. iSCSI and SCSI are protocols that are used at a lower level. They're a block-level protocol, so that the disk really doesn't look at itself in a series of files. It looks at itself as a big stream of data.
Which makes a lot more sense. There's a lot of overhead when you're dealing with addressing files.
Yeah, exactly.
So for example, a database isn't really going to be addressing file system. It's going to have kind of its own native file system. So if you're running like MySQL Oracle database, in reality, this hard drive is storing stuff in a very different way than a file system.
Exactly.
So I got a question with regards to the SCSI moniker.
Yes.
Where does it fit in? Because when you talk about SCSI, you're talking about the
small computer systems interface.
Right. But you're talking about the communication lines for a physical device within a computer. And when you start talking about going over Ethernet, it's not a direct analog anymore. So where does the SCSI come in? Is it because there's some features of SCSI, like tag command queuing?
Exactly. What that really is trying to say and what that means is you're taking the SCSI command set, which tells devices how to behave, primarily disk drives in this case. It also works with tape and tape libraries, which some folks might be familiar with. It's a device-level protocol. It says, okay, robot arm in a library, move from A to B and grab this tape out, and then tell me when you're done. So it's very simple, very kind of back-and-forth command language, but it only works with block-level devices. So iSCSI means I can take that simple command language and package it up and now send it over tremendous distances using a standardized protocol, TCP/IP, or Ethernet.
So the machine that would be using this iSCSI would say, I'm going to want this data next. Or I want this data now. I want this data next. And prepare this data as well. Mm-hmm. And then it's going to be coming down, just like the SCSI interface. In a,
yep.
Okay.
Yep. Simply put, the distance is really the big point here.
I'm glad I think everybody understood exactly what we're talking about with that. Miles, the next news story, sir.
A giant explosion was discovered or observed. It's a supermassive black hole.
So this is not terrestrial?
Right.
Okay, good.
Sorry, this is... No, space explosions are things in, you know, out in the world or out in the universe. It's a supermassive black hole that anchors a distant galaxy. Basically, it's blown two huge bubbles into the galaxy. It's...
How does a black hole push out force? Einstein.
How does it blow bubbles is what I want to know.
I've been working on my astrophysics PhD in my
good.
Apparently, the explosion has been going on for the last 100 million years.
Okay.
And I'm, unfortunately, right now I can't relay this over radio, but I'm looking right now at an artist rendering of what's going on. And it's, think of a nebula.
Mm-hmm.
Like people are familiar with, say, the Horsehead Nebula or the Crab Nebula.
Those pretty things in space. Go on.
Right. And just think this huge ball in the middle that's just bulging out. It's like a big light bulb in the middle of a fog.
Interesting. We're going to have to do a whole show on astrophysics because I'd love to know a little bit more about how external forces can be produced. I mean, you know, outward forces, if you will, can be produced by gravity wells. Doesn't make much sense, but I'm sure there's a way to do it, you know. Yeah. We won't get into it right now, but thank you, Marty.
Well, I mean, that's what the sun is. It's an outward force. It's a,
but it's a bunch very of different than explosions. A black hole. So, yeah. Any case, we'll go on. Miles, your next news story, sir,
is some folks have worked out a way to make some temporary auto paint. This is James Bond style, to be able to spray paint a car and then peel off that paint after you're done.
Or go through the car wash and have it wash off, right? Come out a different car.
I don't know whether this is washable. However, it can be peeled off, is everything I've been finding so
far.
Man,
that is so useful.
So that'd be a great thing to do like as a prank. You know, you just paint someone's car with like really messy, horrible, and it just peels right off.
That or just paint it a different color so they come out and they're like, where's my car?
So does the paint stay a while? I mean, it's not just like a face paint kind of thing, like that day when you come home from the boardwalk, it's gone? Or
I don't know. I don't have in front of me exactly how long it would last. However, I don't imagine it would last all that long considering it can just be peeled off. Yeah, it doesn't require a special catalyst for you to peel it off.
It seems like it would be, you know, fashion statements for your car now. You don't have to worry about it being permanent. You can, you know, go and get your lightning bolts on the side and peel them off. That's right. Like someone covers
I should talk to Bonnie. Like, she can decide you had to put popcorn on her car and take it off or put it on.
That's right. No problem. All right. Miles, thank you for that.
All right.
Silence. I think we're going to go on to our...
Oh, wait. One more.
All right. One more. You go ahead.
This is just kind of cool just to put it out there. Some genetic researchers have isolated the gene that causes AIDS immunity, or immunity to the HIV virus.
Mm-hmm.
They have found that it is it found in an estimated 1% of people descended from Northern European ancestry, mostly Swedes, or people from Sweden. And it's that 1%... of the population descended from Northern Europeans have a complete immunity from the HIV virus.
Wow.
But you have to have both parents have that immunity for you to pass it on. If only one parent has it, you have a resistance to it, mm-hmm. but not the immunity. It's a varying amount of resistance. But basically, researchers are looking into this gene, isolating it, and looking to see how it works and its possible uses for treatment of AIDS.
Very cool. That is a good story. I'm glad you insist that we go for that one next. This is Geek Speak. You're listening to us talk about technology. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Drew Meyer and Miles Elam. And we're going to go on to our topic of the day, which is storage. The entire month of January, GeekSpeak is going to be covering a different solutions for dealing with your data, large amounts of it. And when I talk about data, I'm talking about electronic form, digital form, actually. So what we did was we set up a whole line of shows this month, and we've asked kind of the premier in network storage technology, Snap Appliance, which is now owned by Adaptec, the division of Adaptec, to come on, and that's why Drew is here. And Drew, thank you very much for being here to talk about storage technology.
My pleasure. It's great. You're actually right. We are the number one selling Snap servers are the number one selling network attached storage product in the world.
Very cool.
I'd love to talk about because
yeah,
that's part of that. Yeah. You know?
Speaking of, and it's interesting that Adaptec actually purchased Snap. I didn't know that until we started researching the show. Mm-hmm. And Adaptec, of course, is the premier network company. I mean, they do with network cards.
They do SCSI cards. Largely what they're known for. Yeah. And some people question the purchase, the acquisition, but it makes sense. Adaptec has really branched out into doing a lot more fiber channel networking, which deals with storage area networks or SANs, as well as some of this new cutting edge iSCSI stuff.
Right.
And they're branching out into becoming a storage networking company, which fits with the old legacy of SCSI.
And I would assume that Adaptec has a lot of relationships with drive manufacturers and
board
manufacturers. It's all about integrating with the different technologies to allow SCSI.
And quite a lot of work with operating system manufacturers such as Microsoft to get the drivers all put together.
Right.
And
I guess it also makes sense in that everything is moving away from putting it inside the box and connecting it, whether it be USB hard drive or, for example, network attached storage. I am losing my ability to speak.
You're geek about
let me not let Miles ever finish that sentence. Your lips will just sit there in the air. let's talk about first off why. We obviously cater to the general public who can't understand us, and. And in doing so, most of the people that are listening right now are probably people that have, if they're computer savvy people, they have storage management problems.
Sure.
And I know that Adaptec, Adaptec in general as a company, mostly caters to businesses, small businesses, and large businesses, storage. But let's talk about why storage in general is becoming such a prominent thing in the consumer market and the average everyday Joe kind of situation. What's causing this push for need for more storage?
That's a great question. And there are numerous studies that have been done, and probably the most famous is 2 or 3 years old now, done by the University of California at Berkeley, about the volume of storage and the volume of electronic data that's being created on the planet. And people throw numbers around, and we talk, in my world, it's gigabytes today, but it becomes soon petabytes and nanobytes and yottabytes ultimately, which is, as you can guess, a lot of storage. It's yada with a Y. I don't know why, but it just is. And some Greek or Latin roots to that. I don't know. We should ask our English guy here. But
English? Yeah, not so much Greek.
Lord, okay. Latin, Greek, yeah. Well, the volume of data is increasing immensely, tremendously, and people don't really think about it, but when you start to look at, consider your telephone records, your cell phone records, just the amount of calls that are made. You think about e-commerce, the amount of transactions at a place like Amazon or eBay. All of those are now performed electronically and ultimately stored electronically.
There aren't rooms with filing cabinets for the Amazon orders, for example. Right.
Right. And you look around, here in the studio, there are walls lined with CDs, and ultimately those CDs can be converted to digital format, and they can be accessed from a broader audience at a broader range. They can be accessed faster, and they can be universally available. So it really comes down to networking is driving storage because you want data to be accessible. That's kind of the key for business to be successful. You have to be able to get to your data. And then secondly, backing up that data or duplicating it, replicating it, so that if something happens to your primary data source, your secondary source is
available. Or when something happens to your primary data source.
Yeah, better put, exactly, when something.
And before we go on, I was just actually really curious because about 7 years ago I remembered some article coming out saying that the entire volume of the web was about 2 exabytes of data.
How big is an exabyte, Miles?
Exabyte is 1,000 terabytes.
Okay.
Boy, I'm glad you didn't ask me that.
Yeah, no, I didn't ask you that on purpose because I get you start losing track after
terabyte.
Oh,
wait, no, exabyte comes after petabyte, doesn't it?
I don't know. Really, the next step we're looking
at is
petabytes.
It's 1 million terabytes.
Yeah, so I think it's a step beyond.
Yeah, it's 1 million terabytes. So I was wondering if you had heard any numbers as to what it is now. Like a current metric.
I don't know, and it's so flexible. What I have heard is that the amount of data created in the last few years electronically is equivalent to all of the paper data that's ever been created since the dawn of written history. So You know, that kind
I would
of
say easily.
Yeah.
Really when it comes down to it. Yeah, there's tons of data. Now, so even for a home user that isn't dealing with an Amazon store and things of that nature,
right.
They're still producing a lot more data than we were, individuals were producing 10 years ago. Digital cameras,
exactly.
For example.
Or music. Music and cameras. The media is
that's
really
That's it
driving.
Right there, music
yeah,
and cameras.
You got
yeah,
it. That,
yeah.
That's how we stay in business in a lot of ways.
And home videos, too. Home videos now are mostly done digitally, and you can edit them on a lot of home computers. And that very much changes the way... you deal with storage because, of course, an hour of a raw file, if you will, from a DV camera of an hour is, 10 gigs or
sure,
more.
Sure. And you want to edit it and copy it and slice it up. And
yeah, that's a lot of management of files. I think it's actually more data than that. So these things are causing people to want more and more storage. And as they get their album, and it's only on a hard drive, their photos are all on maybe some music, and they go to Granny's house to share it. Mm. Lots of times people are bringing their content with them some way, mm-hmm. or they're giving the content to people as electronic means, like CDs. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of explosion of this. Another issue, of course, is people have normally multiple computers. They've got computers at home and computers at work, and there's an issue about, I want to see this stuff either wherever I am. And one way to deal with that, of course, there's a couple ways to deal with that we'll be talking about in the rest of the month, will be like portable hard drives where you bring the hard drive with you, or burn CDs or DVDs. We'll be talking about that later in the month, too. But the other solution is something that you're more familiar with, is putting the data somewhere that you can access it from anywhere.
Exactly. And ultimately, I think that's a pretty sophisticated solution, and it works quite well. I mean, the network becomes...
If you've got bandwidth.
If you have bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
Making some assumptions here, right?
Right, right.
But as, you see... DSL and cable becoming more and more prevalent, and the prices dropping, and so bandwidth is becoming available to more and more people. Following on the heels of that high-speed internet access is home networking, which then gives you the opportunity to have multiple computers attached to each other, sharing data in your house, and then you sort of run into the problem of storage management, like you brought up. If I have all my pictures on my computer, and I want to show them to you, and you're on your computer, how do I effectively do that without actually physically copying them somewhere, picking that, what we call the shoe leather network, and walking over to your machine and putting that piece of media in there? Well, a network solves that. You can just come to my computer, see the files that are there, or go to a central repository and see the files without ever having to move anything but electrons.
Okay.
And that's cheap.
And this has been being done for businesses for a long time. It's essential. For example, Amazon, if you pulled that up earlier, mm-hmm. has... of course, tons of data management. I mean, they are dealing with redundancy. They're dealing with fast access. They're dealing, of course, with serving all that content to millions of people all the time. There's a lot of moving data around. So in a business environment, you can see it really clearly. Another example, there's a stove company that I've worked with before here in town, and they sell wood stoves.
Uh-huh.
And they've got their warehouse location and their main distribution location, their front store. And those two places have to know about inventory and all this stuff. And it's a small business. We're talking less than 20 employees and, one or two owners. And, again, they've got to have some way of getting that data back and forth. And burning a CD every morning and walking across town doesn't work. So that's – you can see that it's useful for even a small business.
Exactly.
Here's a good example, too, in the studio. We've got – network storage because I play carts or load audio files in the air room here. They're recorded in another room, and so you can access them from both places and at the same time. And this is, we go back to, I think, a DOS solution here, but it's antiquated and needs to be improved, of course. So it happens all the time in small businesses, and let's talk about it from the home perspective.
Okay.
You've got for example, a Snap 1100, which is a Snap Appliance 1100?
Snap Server 1100.
Snap Server 1100.
Got it, yeah.
And that's kind of one of the ones that you kind of helped pioneer at Snap. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Sure. I started, I suppose the audience is mostly here on the Central Coast, and people might be interested. Meridian Data was the company that invented the Snap Server. Snap Server was the pioneering NAS device, or network attached storage device, about 5 or 6 years ago, it essentially ushered in a new era of network storage. Network storage wasn't really done, or it was costing in the hundreds of thousands mm-hmm. of dollars before that. And the magic here is you take the storage and attach it to the network instead of dedicating it to one computer. So now everybody on the network can see that storage instead of having to go through that one computer. And so Meridian Data put this device together, and some of the guys who wrote the software were actually from around here. And then Quantum, which was a large hard drive manufacturer and today remains a tape and tape library manufacturer, purchased Meridian Data for the Snap Server business in 2000 or so, and kept it on as a division and grew it, and the NAS market grew, and people started to buy this and adopt it as a as a piece of infrastructure in their homes and businesses.
The Meridian was in Watsonville or Monterey?
Scotts Valley.
Scotts Valley. Okay, sorry. Yep. Sorry. And then when Quantum bought it, did it leave the area?
It moved over the hill to San Jose. That's correct. And Quantum ultimately sold the NAS division, the network attached storage division, the Snap Server products, to a group of private investors, which became Snap Appliance. And Snap Appliance lasted for about a year and then was sold to Adaptec. So it's
been around since Adaptec bought Snap.
I joined right when Quantum purchased from Meridian, okay. So about almost 5 years ago.
Right in the beginning of them being kind of the independent producer.
Yeah.
So the Snap 1100, Snap Server 1100, it's kind of, well, we have one, we brought one in, I should have it in front of me, but it's kind of like a small,
paperback book size we talk about, a little bigger than a brick.
Yeah, a thick paperback. It just has two plugs connectors on it and a switch.
Correct.
And the plugs, the power and the Ethernet.
Correct.
And I've used these types of devices before, and I'll be playing with this one and kind of give an update on what we find. You basically plug it into a network and you see it and start using it. It's really simple.
That's the idea. Mm-hmm. We designed it to be installed by somebody, you know, essentially somebody who has zero technical experience. They plug it into the wall and they plug it into their switch or router or hub, an RJ45 connector, and they turn it on and they're done. They walk away. So in 5 minutes, you can take it out of the box, plug it in, turn it on, and it shows up automatically ready to talk to any kind of computer and available for anybody to start saving and retrieving files on it.
And it has, right now, they're kind of being sold in the 80 gig size?
The current model, we designed the 1100 to be an entry-level file server. We were shooting for a $500 price point. We wanted to be able to offer a fully featured standalone file server for around $500. And it launched at 10 gigabytes and is now up to about 80 gigabytes for that same price point. So as you can see, storage is getting cheaper.
Right, of course.
As everybody knows, that's the way the computer
industry
works.
It's getting bigger, right? And so this is a perfect situation where if you have multiple machines in your home, you can throw it in your home. And even a small business, it's a good solution for small business, too. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
This week on This American Life, Arkansas National Guardsmen in Iraq. When they arrive, only 1 in 10 of their vehicles has proper armor.
These 5-ton dump trucks, the youngest one we have is 1956. The newest one we have is 1964.
Stories from a great new documentary, Off to War, and other stories in country this week.
Catch This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
The Health Project Center and Monterey County Respite Coalition presents a free outing for caregivers, including a tour of Monterey Bay Aquarium on January 20th from 10:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Pre-registration is required by January 9th. For information, call 424-4359.
This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning, Miles Elam and Drew Meyer from Adaptec Snap Server, a Snap Appliance division. Please join our conversations. Time is now, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can, of course, use the Internet. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. That'll come in our email, and we'll answer it on air as time permits. But if you want to be with us right now and talking to Drew, Santa Cruz guy, which is nice because he was able to come in the air room. We can hear him really clearly.
Yeah.
But if you'd like to be heard a little less clearly than Drew and join the conversation, you're welcome to do so by calling, again, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We will welcome calls about storage and storage issues or anything, what the heck. So, Drew, you have these solutions for network. One thing about the 1100, of course, it's not the top-of-the-line network storage, because that gets more and more expensive. Features that you see larger, like I was talking about Amazon, but anytime you need to really make sure that, well, you got multiple access points, and that's probably a bad example, Amazon, because it's kind of totally different scale. But one of the things you look for in storage in general is redundancy and backup.
Mm-hmm.
backups being that not necessarily that you access it, but that if something dies, then you still have it. This drive, this Snap 1100,
it's
doesn't
server
have
allow. Server. We like to call it a Snap server. Yeah.
Server 1100.
Because it's totally standalone. And that's right. There's a key differentiator. People look at it and say, gee, $500 for an 80 gig drive. I can go to Santa Cruz Electronics and get an 80 gig drive for $80.
Right.
But it doesn't do the same thing. And the special sauce or the magic sprinkles or whatever you want to call it for us is the software and the fact that we can do all these things that a regular direct attach USB or internal hard drive can't do.
Right.
That's key. So we call it a server.
Okay. So the server, this one doesn't have a redundancy built into it, meaning that it's got one drive inside it.
Right.
Hence the low cost.
Yeah.
You do have other versions that go up and have more redundancy. When you normally talk about hard drive redundancy in one box, you talk about RAID.
Yep.
Can you kind of address what that is and why someone might want that?
Sure. So RAID is a common acronym, one of our beloved acronyms. It stands for Redundant Array of Independent Disks or Independent Drives or Inexpensive Drives. It depends who you ask. But really what it means is that I have multiple disks in one location, and my data is written, so I'm going to use the example of four. We have a Snap server called the 4100 and others called 44X series, and they have four drives in them. The data gets written on, and this is something that the software does, and we manage all this.
The server does this. You don't have to worry about it at all.
You don't think about it. It just happens, yeah. So what's happening down there, the machine is writing data on three of the drives, and it's writing what we call parity data on the fourth drive. And the parity data is basically fancy math for saying A plus B plus C equals D.
Mm-hmm.
And if I lose any one of those letters, any one of those variables, I can reconstruct what it was based on the rest of them. So ultimately, out of my four drives, I have three drives devoted to storage space, and I have one drive's worth of space devoted to the parity data, which means that if one drive fails, I don't lose any data. And that's really key for a lot of folks. They realize that
and
the data is protected.
It's not just that you've got four hard drives and two of them have the same thing as the other two.
No.
Because that would mean that you have half the storage space as the actual drives.
Good
but
point.
In this situation, you have the algorithm of
N minus one.
Which means that if you have four drives and they're all 100 gigabyte, then you actually have 300 gigs of storage that is redundant.
Correct.
And technically it's not an algorithm. It's simply just the amount of amount of storage.
Okay.
There's some sophisticated math in there that I don't claim to understand.
So when we talk about that kind of storage solution, the other thing that happens even with this is that, is it also striped to some degree? Is there some kind of getting data off multiple drives at the same time?
Yeah, and we do that. You can Snap servers are configurable. You can say, I want all four drives to be individual drives. No, obviously we wouldn't recommend that because if you lose one, you lose all your data on that drive. You can set them up to be three drives in a RAID 5 array. What we just discussed, N minus 1, is known as RAID 5. RAID levels are numbered by, obviously these were math people who invented it, but the significance is how many drives are used for data and how many drives are used for parity. And at the 5 number, don't know why.
Right, it's just a number,
five.
I think.
Yeah.
Well, it's just the configuration's changed. Like RAID level 0 was,
right.
There's no redundancy. It's just you put a bunch of drives on there and
the data
drive,
gets shared
if you have like three drives, then one third of the data is written to one drive, one third of the data is written to
right.
the second drive, one third of the data is written to the third
and,
drive.
I mean, RAID 0 is a perfect example of something that you don't do anymore, really.
Nobody
no
does that,
for it.
Yeah. It doesn't make sense.
So RAID 5 would be the situation where you get one extra, there's extra drive that's not, doesn't count for your amount of storage, but it does your redundancy, basically.
Correct.
It's kind of a simplification. But
RAID 5 is generally recognized as one of the best compromises between cost of having drives and performance and redundancy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a good all-around mix of all those things.
Okay, so other solutions like striped. Let's talk about striping.
Striping is another RAID level, and that takes data and writes part of it on the first drive, part of it on the second drive, so that when you retrieve it, you have multiple disk drive heads retrieving all that big stream of data at once, so you get an increase in performance.
You get the data faster.
You get the data. You write it faster and you retrieve it faster. But obviously, if you lose a drive, then your entire stream is lost. And
really badly.
And you lost everything. You're,
right, and that's
game
what RAID,
over.
And that's what RAID 0 is.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Zero redundancy, you could say.
Right.
And then RAID 1, which we also do, is mirroring. And that's a great way to have a lot of backup, but it requires twice as many drives as storage space that you actually need. So it can be expensive.
So, but it's kind of equivalent to what some people do with these USB drives, where they've got their own hard drive and then they copy everything over the drive, and then they do it again, and they kind of have to manage it themselves. And this is basically the server takes care of all that for you.
Yeah.
It's doing that the entire time. So
in
if
real
one
time,
of the when one of the drives fails, as long as you replace it before the other one, you're okay.
Exactly. And one of our other common models has a two drive configuration that you can set up that way.
But RAID 1 has that aspect of, well, it will read twice as fast, or it can read twice as fast,
well,
and it will write one half the speed, because, or not necessarily one half, but it.
Oh, right.
Rules of thumb, yeah. The magic point is that, or the whole point that you. That is key about that is that there are multiple disk heads moving at one time.
Right. So these the formats of different ways of configuring it, you can do that with the software that comes with the Snap appliance.
Yeah,
Snap
and
server.
We designed it to be simple enough that just to point and click your way through and make
for,
it work. Right?
But for the lower end, the home version of this, you're not dealing with redundancy, so you'd still have to deal with the backups. But you were talking about before the show, we were talking about like one of the situations where these devices were caught were the only they were the backup solution.
Yeah.
So you get one of these 1100 servers, and you're getting kind of you just use it only as backup. You never really access it. It's just always getting copies of stuff that you find important. Who uses that, for example, that way?
We've had success. We've been actually astonished by our research data and talking with customers who've purchased these things. We ask them what they use them for because we want to know. We want to design them correctly. And
Makes sense.
We assumed originally that people would use them as file servers, and that's true in probably two-thirds of the time. But we were shocked to find that 30% of our end-user audience is using these as backup devices, and strictly backup devices. They're basically targets on their network, and when they perform a backup, they write the data to this file server instead of, for example, to a tape or a DVD burner or whatever. And the advantages that they came back and told us were that they're getting much better performance because they're writing to a disk at a disk speed, which is
and
quick.
Traditionally, you do this with tape.
Right.
It's much slower.
It's much slower, and the capacities aren't there, and if the... It requires software usually to manage the tape, and it can be complicated and expensive. And with the Snap server, you put it on a credit card, it shows up in the mail, you plug it in, turn it on, forget about it, and start doing your jobs, and it's done. And for example, Costco, in all of their pharmacies in the United States, they've been able to replace tape drives attached to computers with Snap servers. And it's both lower cost to buy the hardware, and it's much more reliable for them. They know that the job gets done instead of having to depend on someone to change the tape out.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so the value to them was not so much in having the off-site archive capability of tape, but in getting the data backed up at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's a subtle point, but it's critical. You know?
Yeah, of course.
If nobody changes the tape, then that data is exposed, and you're at risk.
And, of course, you can manage you manage Snap appliances with a web interface, which is kind of nice.
Yeah,
so,
from anywhere.
So, you know, some central office that manages the Costco drugstores can... be making sure that drive that it's functioning and the backups are there, and they can of course then archive those centrally if they want. I have a question for you though. That becomes interesting. Mm-hmm. You talk about pharmacy. Pharmacy has of course medical information. Medical information should be extremely private. What about security?
Okay, so that's a great question and one that the storage industry is very intrigued in and analyzing right now. There's a standard called HIPAA, the Health Information Portability Protection Act, something like that, HIPPA. And it was passed by the government in order to provide protection and security on personal health records. And it's requirements so that they have to be archived securely and they have to be accessible for a period of 7 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's significant and it's revolutionizing the healthcare industry because doing that in a paper style, while possible, is not efficient. And so electronic storage is getting a big boost from that. At the same time, it's raising all kinds of questions. How do we ensure to the absolute 100% nth degree that this data can never be overwritten or modified? You know,
right.
This is the stuff of spy movies, right, where people go in and modify something and erase their tracks and you never know.
Right, right.
And insurance companies can't have that happening and hospitals can't have that happening. So
it's interesting.
It's tricky.
These rules that come on high from politicians that about technology are always kind of interesting. There's a California rule about a database. If there's a potential for the data to be stolen, you have to notify everyone in the database. If the database contains a phone number and a social security number or a phone number and an address or, you know, with a name. And so there's all these rules about managing people's records. And it's very important. If a credit card company gets broken into, for example, and your private information is stolen potentially, mm-hmm. it'd be nice if you knew about it. That's the basic idea of the law. But when it comes down to it, you never really know if your data has been tampered with. You can try to get this secure as possible. But as you say, I mean, given some miracle of a hacker being able to do something, it's possible for that person to protect themselves. So mm-hmm. one way to be really safe from the law is just send an email or send a letter to every one of the people every month that says we might have been broken into. But at least
which
it
is not useful.
Which
at all.
Is not useful at all. But exactly what the actual reality is. So, but it has these laws, of course, really do help make things more protective because the company has to think about it part of their bottom line. We got Joe Vila from Santa Cruz emailing us in. Can I use video DVD? To convert analog and digital camcorder movies to a DVD. And that's an Adaptec product. Are you familiar with that product?
Oh, no. Joe, no. You picked the wrong guy.
I know.
I'm not an expert in the Adaptec software products, and so I don't know specifically the answer. But I will take your email address and get to the right folks.
Okay, I've got it. I'll forward it to you. Shouldn't be a problem. I'm looking at, of course, the website right now. It's a product from Adaptec. Adaptec's a very large corporation. Video DVD Media Center is what the thing is, ODVD. And it says it contains Sonic MyDVD video creation software. So, yes, you can do exactly that. You can make DVDs with that package. It looks like it is a... I'm not sure exactly what the package is, but it does come with Sonic's MyDVD, and MyDVD video creation is a really simple way to make home videos. I've used it. I think it's a great little product. So, Joe, you're set. If you're going to get that, that's a great way to make home videos. Just make sure that you know your machine can do all the things that are required for that package. Thanks for the email. I'm going to welcome people to call in with questions and comments about technology in general. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. The phone lines are empty. You are available to come in right now and talk to us, the geeks. Again, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, like Joe, you can go ahead and send an email in. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us.
So hey, before we leave Joe along,
yes,
hey, Joe, if you're out there listening, and I assume you are because you sent an email, you're a prime candidate or a perfect example of why storage is important in the home. I'm curious if you wouldn't mind writing us back an email. Tell us how you're storing the data that you've captured on your video camera. I mean, do you have a storage problem? Do you have enough space? What do you do with it once you convert it to a movie? Then you're going to put it on a DVD. Then what are you going to do with it? These are the kind of issues that are driving storage today, and it's great to have somebody who's got firsthand experience.
I do videos, video editing at home, and I'll just answer that question from my perspective of how I manage it. One of the things that happens when you're dealing with DV cams, they're digital tapes, they're big. You encode those as an AVA file when you first import them into products like Sonic's MyDVD. You import them in, and then you edit them with some software on your machine, and then you make your final movie kind of thing and burn a DVD. The DVD that gets created from that file is actually not as good a quality and as easy to use in editing as the original DV tape, because it's not a frame recording like an AVA file is. You actually have a MPEG algorithm which, you know, it builds upon itself. So when you look at it in a streamline, you have to load it. It takes a while to load, and you don't have a really clear picture. You've got merges between two pictures all the time. So it's not as fun to edit that way. It's harder to sync things, audio and video, to sync them together. So using editing with digital is great. So what happens, of course, is you make your movie, you put it in your hard drive, you can't store all the videos you create. There's not enough. You need terabytes, of course. That's what I'd like, is just terabytes at home. That'd be wonderful. So instead, you make your DVD, and then the question is, do you get rid of those DV tapes? Because you got to store it somewhere. I mean, if you want the original files, you got to save those guys, or you've got to save the AVI files, if you will. Of course, you can save the AVIs and burn them onto DVDs, but it's a problem. So let's say I had tons of money and didn't even think of it as an option, you know, an issue, and I wanted to be able to make sure that things are backed up. What kind of network storage solution could I get and put it in a garage so it's not too loud? What could I get from you guys that would give me a terabyte or two terabytes.
You know, that, well, in a perfect world.
And why aren't you making that for users that like me? No.
Well, you know, it's just a matter of cost here, Lyle. We'd be happy to supply that to you. Just lay down the $5,000.
Let me sell my house. Yeah. No, but
it's not that bad. And our most commonly sold model to all of our consumers and through our resellers is the 1 terabyte version of the SnapServer 4500. And that's a 1U. It's like a pizza box format. It's designed to mount in
a rack,
an IT rack. Yep. bolts into the in from the front, and it has four drives in it, and it has a power supply and some fans, and it's a little bit noisy because it's got nice fast processors in there, but it stores a terabyte of data native, so it's got four 250 gigabyte hard drives in it.
So it's not redundant. It doesn't have.
The drives are automatically set to RAID 5, so you are dealing with about 750 gigabytes of usable storage.
Okay.
And the fans are swappable. You can take them. You can, if they fail, you can shut the machine down and repair them. They're not hot swappable, but they are replaceable. But the drives are hot swappable, which mm-hmm. means if a drive were to fail, the light on the front of the machine would go on. You could walk up to it with a replacement drive in your hand. While the machine's running, you pull out the dead drive, put in the replacement drive, and it fixes everything and syncs everything on its own. It never goes down. So that's key to a lot of our users. But that's around $5,000. It's a terabyte of storage, and you can grow that storage if you want up to 3 terabytes by adding additional hard drive arrays. And that seems to be kind of the sweet spot in the market right now. So much as I'd like to help you out with that, I don't think I can, but everybody should have one in their garage.
Exactly,
in your opinion,
because then, you know, people like Joe and me can just store all the video we want forever.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Not really, for a year.
Oh, I would like to say that there are no engineers that I know that do that, but I can't say that.
So. Yeah.
There are guys with many terabytes in their garage.
Nice. I should just go get a job there. That's the solution. Noel from Santa Cruz, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, Noel.
What's your question?
Yeah, I have a question about using a product called Skype, which is a voice over IP for making calls over the internet, which my brother sent me from Cyprus. And I'm having trouble when I get into a conversation with him on my Macintosh. I'm getting this weird internal level on the microphone that it's like a buzz that obliterates our conversation. I was wondering...
Is it like a feedback?
He's saying, I can't actually hear it, but he's saying it's just like a buzz, like a noise buzz of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Does it only happen when he's talking to you?
Yes. So we're pretty sure it's my end of
right.
the...
Right. Well, okay, there's a couple things to do with this. Go ahead and, I was just looking for before the show for a open source recording solution for... For Macintosh, but what you can do is first off get something that will record on the Mac. There's free apps out there, and go ahead and record mic in and see, and then play that recording and see how that sounds. If that's really bad, it is possible you have a hardware issue. Mm-hmm. I think more likely it's configuration of the software.
Right.
Have you gone into the sound settings? I'm assuming in the control panel.
That's right.
Yeah. It's possible for the microphone to be being played back through the speakers, which would cause horrible feedback stuff. You would probably hear that, though. Another solution, and this might be the way to go. This product, what I do for voice over IP stuff, and I haven't done a lot of this, you can, of course, buy a phone, even for Skype, for example. You can buy a phone that then plugs in.
Okay.
And that's one solution. That's going to be like €80. But, you know, that's one way to do it. The other way to go is to get, like, a headset with a microphone on it.
Yeah.
Plantronics, which is a Santa Cruz company, I have one of those. It's a USB connector. It avoids basically the internal sound system completely of the Mac. If you're even having hardware problems, that's great. The
that
OS
sounds
10,
like a good idea.
Yeah, you grab one of those, you put it on. The wonderful thing about that, of course, is that there can't be feedback because the microphone and this headphones are separated and the headphones are producing low volume. So then what you do is when you plug that thing in, you'll go into your sound settings and you'll see that you just set up your input and your output to be from the Plantronics headset, whatever headset. And then when you launch the application, it should just start playing it through that and you won't get the issues that you're probably running into.
And those are Mac-friendly, are they, those headsets?
Yeah, for a while they weren't, and then and I kept on calling Plantronics going, what's going on? The standard answer was the OS X hasn't been built to really handle these yet. They're working on it. And then one day I did a Mac update, and presto, it works great. There's even
terrific.
A little mute and a volume button on the cable, so you don't have to touch the keyboard or anything to mute it, which is kind of nice.
What do those run at? Like,
you know, I don't know, but it's Plantronics.com.
Yeah, my buddy works there. Maybe he can get me a deal.
That's the way to go. That's how I got mine.
Good help, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the call.
Bye.
Well, we're going to go ahead and go to Jenny, who's in Santa Cruz as well. Jenny, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, you guys know a lot of stuff. I've got, a pretty basic problem. I'm trying to move data from my hard drive to make room onto just a CD on an external iOmega CD-RW. And when I put the disk in, it says to initialize it, and I say okay, and then it says disk is locked.
Yeah.
What, is that just cheap media?
You shouldn't have to initially... Where do you get the iOmega burner? How old is it?
Fry's. It's about a year and a half old. It was refurbished.
Well, initializing refers to you're doing packet writing.
Starting the file system. It means you're starting to write on the CD.
Well, it's not... writing something to it, but you're writing to it with packet writing.
Yeah.
It's treating it like a drive.
What software is the problem then?
Well, what software says that it has to initialize?
Yeah, well, it's just the basic system. I'm not even running software. I've tried their Hotburn, but it's not compatible with my 9-point blah, blah, whatever.
Yeah.
And then I... trying to get Toast on there, but I need to make room to get Toast on. So
right. Okay. Yeah, that's the problem. So when you bought this product, they only have an OS 10 version for it. You've got OS 9.2 or something like that.
Yeah.
OS 9.2, when it shows up, it's normally what the drive is going to do is it's going to, you know, if you put a CD in, since it's USB, it's going to auto-mount, and you've got USB drivers enabled.
Yeah.
So, you know, auto-mounting a drive is like, oh, cool. But OS 9, when it says, you know, mount this drive, by the way, I don't understand this file system, it's going to say, let's erase the drive and get ready for it, initialize it. That's the old Mac 9.
I want to get to 10, but I need to get stuff off.
Right. Okay. So you've got to catch 22. Is this a laptop or a desktop machine?
It's a G3 blue. The turquoise
tower.
One.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
All right. So I think the best solution for you, because you know USB is working, is to go get a, well, either a network storage device, or since we have Drew here, or you could go ahead and get a USB drive.
Or a FireWire.
A FireDrive.
Yeah.
And then put the data on there. And that, I think that you're going to have to do that, because unless you can find, well, see, if you have a copy of Toast, you're set, but there's not enough room for Toast to be installed. That's an issue.
How much room do you need, Jenny? Do you know?
I think I need to move off about a meg, a couple megs maybe.
Oh, so you're really tight on there?
Really a meg or a gigabyte?
Do
you know?
Well, if I can, yeah.
Well, the G's came with like 10 gigs.
How big is the
so,
yeah, 10
yeah,
gig
she's
drive.
Probably talking about a meg.
Okay, well, you should maybe getting a USB thumb drive or a little flash chip.
Okay.
You know?
That's a good idea.
It'd probably be cheap.
Yeah, like 128 megabyte.
Right.
But the thing is, if you're running OS 9 and you're going to try to burn a CD, one of the issues with burning a CD is you want all the data really set up and ready to go. And the way normally that's done is the machine collects the whole data and then writes it kind of serially and kind of preps it.
Right.
And you won't have enough room to prep it. So that's kind of a problem, too. Toast can do it on the fly, but if your system is slow, especially a USB burner,
You know that
I would get external hard drive. You'll always love it.
You can't go wrong. You'll have enough space to go forward in the future. You won't have to worry about burning something again when you have when your disk runs out of space.
I was trying to archive in smaller units.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah, I think getting an external drive, even a small one, and then moving off there, and then going ahead and archiving with your CD, which you should be able to do.
Okay.
I think that's the way you're going to have to do it. You could borrow one from a friend if someone's got a USB drive. That's the way to do it.
What about the Discribe software?
Don't know about it.
Okay.
You stumped us.
Never heard of it. What does it do?
Maybe I have the name wrong. It was on the iOmega website as an alternative for Mac OS 9.
I think you're going to run into the same... Oh, that's a good solution, but I think you're going to run into the same kind of problem where you're not going to have enough space to make the temporary...
To set up the data.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is a storage problem, not a software problem at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, another way to do it, go and spend a little bit more money and get a network storage device.
Okay.
Like from that's right.
How many computers do you have, Jenny?
Right, not just that one.
Doesn't make sense. Get a FireWire drive. Go to
USB drive.
USB.
I don't think FireWire is on the G.
On the OS 9 G3. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Lacey is a company that makes good stuff for Macs.
Okay.
If you're looking for a brand.
Yeah, great.
Okay.
Thank
Santa
you,
Cruz
Jenny.
Electronics, place to go.
Thanks for your help.
Hey, thank you very much.
Thanks.
For
Bye.
Unfortunately, we got one more call from Doug in Davenport. We're not going to be able to get to you. But, well, you know what? Let's just do it quickly. Doug, shoot. What's your question and quick?
Hello?
Yes. Hi.
Yeah, I just purchased a 200-gigabyte hard drive, and I was wondering, I had my computer CPU upgraded, new motherboard, to a Pentium 4, and I kept my old hard drive in there.
20 gig,
And, 20 gig. And I was just wondering, do you think it's a good idea to, I mean, I've never done it before, installing an internal hard drive and... that size, whether or not it's compatible, as opposed to you guys were just talking about it, external.
Unfortunately, I can't answer this call. We're running out of time.
Okay.
We'll answer it. Why don't you go to geekspeak.org and send us an email,
okay,
and
great.
We'll answer it that way. Thank you very much for the call.
Thanks.
Doug from Davenport. Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam, one of our regular geeks, and Drew Meyer from Adaptech. I want to thank you both for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Lyle.
Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you very much for being here every week, Maggie. And to those of you that called into Geek Speak, thank you for listening and joining us. We're here every week. The entire month of January, we'll be covering storage technologies. And I really want to appreciate Drew coming on and kind of setting us up for the month of storage and also solutions that would be kind of the end-all, be-all, in my opinion, of terabytes at home. Next week, we'll be here at 10 talking with Plexor, makers of hard drives. Coming up next is Open Road at 1 p.m., Two Steps in the Blues with Charlie Lang. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Otto, on the web at kusp.org.